Yes, indeed. It's over three decades since Nirvana changed rock and roll. The album came out with Smells Like Teen Spirit, of course, Nevermind, which absolutely sent a torpedo into the rock establishment and unleashed grunge onto a hitherto unsuspecting public. It is three decades since that all happened, and there's a new book out, there's a new tome out called Nirvana, The Complete Illustrated History, and it's compiled and written by Andrew Earls, and I'm delighted to be joining me live on the line from the States, Andrew himself. Andrew, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. It's really strange, isn't it? Because Smells Like Teen Spirit, you just pop it on the vinyl or stick it on your whatever media player, and it absolutely leaps at you like a whirling dervish.
Absolutely. I remember that. I actually remember where I was the first time I heard it.
That's strange you should say that as well, because I do too. And where I saw it was a British late night rock show called, I was going to say The Tube, but it was called I can't remember. Anyway, it was late night music. And I just thought, what on earth is this? Because we were in the 80s, we were at the end of the 80s, was big hair rock. And the most dangerous band in the world were being touted as Guns N' Roses. And then this lot arrived and we went, what on earth?
Yeah, I was in high school, and a friend of mine came over to my house and said, I just heard this amazing song on our college radio station here. And he's like, you know, but we had to tune in and wait on them to play it again, you know, back then.
Of course.
So.
Yeah, for those who were born before, you know, before Spotify and all streaming services, it was a period of that, wasn't it? You had to wait till it came on either the MTV or the radio station itself.
That's right. Yeah, to go searching for it, but before long, it was everywhere.
Yeah, and I mean the thing with Nirvana, I suppose, was the fact that it really led to an avalanche of grunge music, because without Nirvana, although it proved the entry point to that Seattle sound that included Pearl Jam, Blind Melon, and of course Soundgarden, and this was a movement that was, certain that are still out there and going, but there was a period of time in that early 90s that it absolutely defined sort of Generation X in a way that was completely different to the, as I said before, those big-haired rockers that had come before.
No, it was definitely a paradigm shift. Absolutely. As best as I can remember it was, there had been a couple of records that had maybe laid the groundwork as far as loud guitars go prior to Nevermind a little bit, like the first Smashing Pumpkins record. You know, maybe even to a, you know, an indirect way, maybe some Ministry and the Metallica Black album and Jane's Addiction had, you know, introduced, I guess, loud guitars to the mainstream already, but there hadn't been a real, you know, there hadn't been anything to really come up out of.
If you think about the way that you mentioned your Jane's Addiction, perhaps the Chili Peppers as well, it was that's very much that sort of Californian sort of, there was a sort of rock and roll sensibility already about it. Coming out of Seattle, where it rains all the time and it's dark, the image wasn't everything, was it, in this case? It wasn't Flea leaping around with a pink mohawk.
No, and Nirvana themselves actually came from, you know, quite a different background than even Soundgarden or, you know, Alice in Chains. They came from the same scene, but there was a bit of a different, you know, the bands that Nirvana was adjacent to, you know, prior to their exploding or getting huge were a little different, because that was, you know, Nirvana was more contemporaneous with, say, something like the Jesus Lizard or, you know, noise rock, as it was referred to back then. But, you know, eventually everything exploded and it all got lumped into grunge. But
Yeah, I mean, there were the tale, weren't they, of because this is back in the day before YouTube and social media, so A&R men scurrying up to Seattle to try and find, you know, anything that sounded vague. I mean, if you had a bad haircut and a terrible jumper, you had half a chance of getting a record deal.
That's true, and they were even scouring places you wouldn't even think. I'm from Memphis, Tennessee, and we even had A&R people here. Oh. You know, going through the clubs and everything.
Now
and it was, yeah.
I'm just thinking Memphis grunge. Now that's a subsection I hadn't even thought about, but that would be Southern grunge. Amazing.
Yeah, well, it's happened, you know, in maybe not in a take over the world manner, but we're more than Elvis and rockabilly.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the book then, the complete illustrated history. What is the aim? Because again, the problem with Nirvana is, I mean, and I'm sorry for talking an awful lot about this, but it is a band that I absolutely adore and what came after as well. But the Nirvana became, they burned bright, they exploded, we know the story, and then suddenly in the past sort of 5 years, every sort of YouTube kid is wearing a Nirvana t-shirt in the same way that they wear a Ramones t-shirt, and I look at them and go, you guys probably don't know a damn thing, and that is not those exact words, but a damn thing about the band and how Cobain would probably have hated all that.
Yeah, it is, they really have, I mean, in some ways I think that it's a positive thing, because there's a lot worse influences out there that, you know, young kids could be getting into from 20 or 30 years ago than Nirvana. I think it's a good thing, you know, as far as like it being a big influence on people that weren't around, or, you know, or young people just coming up. But yeah, it's huge. It's in a way it's surprising, and in a way it's not, because, you know, it's a generation that they didn't have their, you know, that's their Ramones, you know,
yeah,
if you will.
So with the book itself, then, is it aimed at, you know, people like myself who are in their, you know, hit the 50s and the late 40s, and they were their first time around, it was their music. And so it's a look with some stuff that you wouldn't have got through the normal channels, and also for that generation who have come since, and, you know, like the t-shirt and no team spirit and that sort of thing, and like, because, you know, Cobain, for better or worse, was an icon. He was visually outstanding with his look. Nobody's looked like, as, you know, like him. And to say this is the meat behind the music.
Sure. The book is I should clarify that I am the editor of the book.
Yeah.
I did write probably a third to a half of it. But there's a lot of other writers in the book too. And it goes deep enough to satisfy, you know, the heads out there like yourself. And it's also a good starting place as well for people.
One of the things is, Andrew, I mean, again, because if it was just, and I interview writers all the time about, especially on this show, about bands, and some of them are quite niche, and it's been written by one person, and you think, okay, well, maybe that band from the northwest of England didn't have that much of a fan base, but it goes to say something about the impact that Nirvana had culturally, musically, socially, that you can gather writers, and people still debate Cobain, and they still, you know, they still look at his, and there's something pure, they say, about, you know, about his music, and also, obviously, the fact that Dave Grohl has gone on to do what Dave's done in an amazing way, and Chris has just sort of just gone back to being Chris, basically. I mean, obviously, Kurt's no longer with us, Dave's got the Foo Fighters, and Kurt just gets on with his life being, you know, being a musician and doing what on earth he wants to.
Yeah, Chris, I believe he became pretty politically active, you know, over here. I don't want to speak out of school, and I'm not sure exactly what his focuses were on, but, yeah, Grohl has gone on to do, you know, create his universe, Foo Fighters and beyond. And Dave Grohl is, he was drumming in, a band before Nirvana when he was a teenager. He came from the DC hardcore band Scream. I think what Nirvana, what they were at the forefront of, I guess, and kind of are associated with in the early 90s, that sort of paradigm shift and the major label feeding frenzy that followed and everything. They are kind of the band that everybody points to, for that sort of, I don't know, it completely, turned everything on its head.
Well, yeah. I mean, they blew up, didn't they, so quickly? I mean, in terms of one minute they was nowhere, and the next minute they were everywhere. And not just in terms of album shifting units, was it radio-friendly unit shifter? But in terms that Nevermind was everywhere, the front cover is iconic, and the less said about that baby, now he's a grown man, the better, I think. But...
that's right.
How to Get Yourself Hated by basically every rock person in the world.
forgot about that.
But also, suddenly they were doing world tours, and this is a band who'd been, had been on the, in the scene in Seattle and sort of the West Coast, and then they're doing, then they're doing Europe and they're doing the world, and this wasn't, this isn't a boy band. These haven't been carefully plucked. They're just doing it for the music and the fun of the music. They don't want to do the whole star thing, and this is what. Again, it was sad about Cobain, because you can argue that they were manipulated, or they were enabled by the record labels, because nobody was really looking after their health or had prepared them for this, and it went in such a big way that suddenly if the labels could have cloned them and sent them in 15 different places at once, they would have done.
Oh, sure. Definitely. Yeah, and it happened so fast, and they were kind of, there was no guidebook. They were kind of they were just thrown into the fire. I mean, I remember, I didn't catch the shows a little bit before my time, but I seem to remember that Nirvana actually coming to Memphis and playing, I think it was right before Nevermind came out, and they came and they played to maybe about 100 people or something. And it wasn't 6 months after that, 6 to 8 months after that, they were literally knocking Michael Jackson off the number one slot in January of 92. Yeah.
But again, it's a thing that they just were the sound. There was a paradigm shift from that big hair music of the 80s. And I said before, your Guns N' Roses, your White Snakes, all that huge thing, the big hoary rockers. And it was suddenly a music that was accessible to the kids or to the young people, and they can say, I can do that, and I can go out and have a band like that, and I can, because every, it's music is, it changes through the time. There's a time period, it's a circle. So, every generation has to have a band that they can just get behind and scream at the world with. And Nirvana, those three men absolutely provided it.
That's right. Yeah, I agree. It was, sure. And the major labels did, they tried to clone a bunch of Nirvanas and send them in a bunch of different directions. There were a bunch of, major label created bands, suddenly out of nowhere. So that, they attempted to do it. And, the message that anybody can do it, it kind of was a double-edged sword in a way. The DIY message was certainly positive to younger bands and everything. And then, but the major label kind of took it and, had a model to kind of create bands in boardrooms.
Yeah. What was again, you've compiled this with photographs. You're bringing together the writings as well, which must be, if you're editing something, that's always good fun to get a sort of like continuous to make a, because, editing a book is even harder work than, dashing off 1,000 words about a band, because you've got to make sure it makes, and I'm not blowing smoke up your proverbials here, Andrew, but there's a subtle art to editing to make sure all, and then you've got to have the images, and this book is absolutely chock-a-block, as we say. with these images, and also the bits and pieces that perhaps you don't know, because a lot of us have seen pictures before of Nirvana, but there are things like, you know, backstage photography, ticket stubs, gig sure. posters, all that sort of thing, which really, you know, gives, like I said, gives a feeling and gives some gives that little insight that we all love.
Yeah, that would have been my publisher and editor compiling that those things. I love it. Editing is a some people think it's a slog, and I guess it can be, or rather, not to use some American slang there, but it's kind of a, you know, it can be toiling, you know, to edit. But I love it. I love the process. I love going through things and correcting them, and you know, and the fact checking and the research, and it's something I really
well, especially
to,
something like
dive into
something like this, Andrew. I mean, I used to edit property magazines, and trust me, that I'd edit a Nirvana book would have been an awful lot better than doing square meters on a condo.
Sure. Look, I've done that type of writing as well.
Looking at the other, because we were just going on about the impact they had, but you know, there was the one of the great albums is MTV Unplugged, and the way that had again, it's one of the, it's just Nirvana kept doing great things, and that concert, that performance, it still stands the test of time, as they say, and everybody sure. thought this band, who were primarily loud and screaming, and then we have you know, introduced, and this still makes me laugh as well, you know, the man who sold the world, and people saying, wow, I never knew, who's this Bowie guy, and
and the Meat Puppets cover was another big one for that band too.
And it
turned people on to a lot of the music they had not been exposed to before, I think. And it shows the band had was multidimensional in a way that, like, you know, a more manufactured band couldn't be.
And then, of course, sounds really weird, but 30 years ago, with In Utero, and there was a big build-up, and I remember this because, obviously, I was running around London at the time, and it was like the second album from... And we were all kind of expecting... more noise, if you like, more,
sure.
because by that time, everybody knew every word and every chord and every structure to Nevermind. So we thought more of this, and it's a completely different album. And it took, and my first look was like, okay, what's this then? And it took a while to get into it, but perhaps that's the hallmark of a great album. But obviously the record label wasn't, they would have liked Nevermind volume 2, 3, 4, 5 to infinity, and they got In Utero instead.
Sure. It's my favorite. In Utero's become my favorite, definitely. I'm a big fan of Albini's production and in general, and I think that that's definitely my favorite album as it stands now, and I think it's their best, and probably, you know, who knows what they would have done next.
Yeah,
but they probably you know, it's tough to speculate. Maybe made something not quite as loud next, but who knows?
The other thing is the fact that you can have great what ifs, and you know, the Nirvana Christmas album perhaps would have been something
sure.
to behold. But
yeah,
when it comes to putting something down like this, though, isn't it because, again, you know, Cobain is dead, and it's very easy to make people folk heroes and rock heroes, and you know, as Amy Winehouse go to prove, you know, you pop out a couple of albums and then you die, and your record label, and I mean this in the most reverential way, I'm not being facile about this, but it seems to be that people now. And Lennon, John Lennon as well, people go, oh, it was, you know, it's as though they were almost sainted. And it must be very difficult to actually compile something like Nirvana, The Complete Illustrated History, and avoid that cliche of making Kurt some sort of like shining angel from above, because he had problems, you know, there were difficulties. There was massive drug problems. There were difficult relationship problems.
Sure. It's a tough tightrope to walk. I mean, luckily there's like, you know, there were other writers involved to kind of handle those sort of things in their way, and as well, and in their own way. I try to approach that stuff very, very carefully and respectfully. Because I really still to this day don't think we really understand what was going on there. 100%. who knows, you know, who knows how bad it scrambled someone's eggs to become famous that quick.
Yeah, exactly.
And I certainly don't know. So
that's a great phrase, by the way, Andrew. I'm going to use that. Who knows how quickly it scrambles someone's eggs? I'm going to take that from today's, and I'm going to use that in future.
It's all yours.
And one of the things where did you get this thing about Kurt Cobain's 50 all-time favorite albums? Because I've never come across this before, and that
it was published in his the book that came out years ago. That was a commercial publishing of his journals,
right?
The Kurt Cobain journals book, and he had written a list of he's kind of a list maker, and he had written a list of his 50 favorite albums or most influential albums or the 50 albums that have had the biggest impact on Nirvana, and that list had existed out there, and I just annotated it and kind of fleshed it out and, you know, gave each album a description so people could, you know, go check it out. And,
next question is going to be, what was number one? I mean, was it, you know, it wasn't anything by sort of Donny and Marie Osmond or anything, was it?
No, number one was, I don't have it in front of me, and I should remember it, but I don't quite remember what number one was. It may have actually been, that's embarrassing.
Sorry, it happens all the time. I just remember what that TV program was. It was called The Word back in the UK, and that was their first TV appearance on the UK, and that it was a late night TV program, and it shocked the nation. And I was sitting in a because we were all living in a flat in a house share in a place in Wimbledon in London, going, what on earth is this? Because all we'd heard before, the heaviest we got was Paradise City, so you can imagine how much of a shock that was. What do you hope? Sorry, go on.
I'm sure. Yeah. No, the big shock in America was their performance on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah. What do you hope?
And the video going huge on MTV was a big, big deal as well.
Yeah. The dark cheerleading video was something else, wasn't it? As you can probably tell, Andrew, I could talk to you about Nirvana until probably Monday morning. We're coming up to the news at the moment. So if people are going to take something from the book, or is it to discover, because there's things like there's the backline stuff as well. There's the gig lists and all that. So just to prove that there is technical ability in there. It wasn't just a bunch of sort of Northwesterners whacking away on guitars and whatever.
Yeah,
so
of course.
What do you hope that people take from the book?
I just hope people, learn something new they don't already know about the band, and then go out and discover all of the equally as amazing bands that were influenced by or were an influence on Nirvana or influenced by them that are lesser known, and dive into that universe.
Yeah, there are worse universes to dive into. The book is called Nirvana, The Complete Illustrated History. It's been edited and compiled, and my congratulations to you on this by Andrew Earls. Andrew, are you on social media? Can people find you?
Yeah, I am. I have an Instagram at Grotto, Grotto _of_ miracles.
Ooh, that's good.
At Instagram. Yeah.
Oh, I like that one. Grotto _of_ miracles. The book is called Nirvana, The Complete Illustrated History. It's by Andrew Earls. It will also be available as a download from our own virtual bookstore. Andrew, I'm going to play out with Heart Shaped Box because I can. Andrew, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Likewise. Thank you so much.